Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We're up to nearly 200 episodes, lots of great guests, but no show so far about a novel.
And that's about to change. Our discussion today is about The Wall, a dystopian story in a post-climate change world.
A wall is built to keep migrants out at all costs, and anyone who lets them in will be deported. Us versus them, The Wall, with John Lanchester.
I think it's psychologically very difficult, climate change. I think it's a very difficult subject to look straight at. There's the French aphorist La Rochefoucauld said, death, like the sun, cannot be contemplated directly. In other words, you can't look straight at it. It's not the thing we can easily get our heads around, we can easily process. And I think one of the things that it's possible to do in fiction and in other artistic forms is to in a way slip past the radar, slip under the radar, slip past people's defences, to make things thinkable in a way that it's actually quite difficult to look straight at them.
Our show is about fixes.
Yeah, how to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Richard, you know, we talk a lot about climate change. We've touched on this issue in a number of shows. There's no question that the rise of carbon in the Earth's atmosphere will have significant effects on the climate, quite possibly including worse droughts, more severe storms, rise in sea level, change in weather patterns, droughts, which in turn could lead to all kinds of mass migration.
Yeah, but how could climate change and those changes you're talking about change ourselves, our politics, our society? Will we grow much more dogmatic, defensive, fearful? Today we look at a story that suggests where we might be headed if we don't act with open eyes and open hearts to limit climate change.
In The Wall by John Lanchester, an island nation builds an enormous concrete barrier around its entire coastline. The defenders who patrol it have one task: stop the others from breaching the wall and getting in.
Our guest is the author of The Wall, John Lanchester, a British journalist, essayist, and novelist. Welcome to How Do We Fix It?
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with this story, which follows a fellow called Joseph Kavanaugh, who has been enlisted as a new defender on The Wall. He's in fact been drafted into something called the Coastal Protection Force.
Yes, it's set in a world after catastrophic climate change, and it's set in an island in the North Atlantic that's a sort of altered version of Britain. And the whole island has a 10,000 kilometre, 6,000 mile long concrete wall running all the way around it. And everyone in the country, every citizen in the country, has to spend 2 years standing guard on the wall, which is partly there to keep the water out, the high flood levels after the catastrophic climate change. And it's also partly to keep out the millions of desperate people fleeing other parts of the world trying to get to the island for safety. It's a world altered by about 4 degrees centigrade, 8-9 Fahrenheit warmer, never spelt out in the book. They just refer to it as the change, but it's this sort of alteration in climate. And everyone in this island nation, surrounded by this concrete monster wall that you described, as a sort of condition of citizenship, you have to spend 2 years standing guard on it as a defender, where your job basically is to keep out the people they refer to as the others, who are those, you know, starving, desperate millions of people fleeing the now uninhabitable parts of the world.
And it's a pretty brutal form of military service. Like, what happens to you if you don't succeed and a couple of those others manage to sneak by?
Well, what happens is if in the course of your two-year turn of duty, if one of the others gets over the wall on your watch, you yourself are put to sea and become another in your turn. And the people who get over the wall are given a three-way choice. They can choose to be euthanized, which means to be medically killed, put down in the way that we put down sick animals. They can be put back out to sea, or they can become what in the book they call help, which is a form of slavery or indentured servitude.
And what did you look to kind of shape your ideas about what this post-climate change world would be like?
I tried to stay on top of the science over the last few years. It's quite difficult to do, not so much for technical reasons, but I think it's psychologically very difficult, climate change. I think it's a very difficult subject to look straight at. There's the French aphorist La Rochefoucauld said, death, like the sun, cannot be contemplated directly. In other words, you can't look straight at it. And I think something like that is true of climate change. So I've tried to kind of stay current with what the science is saying, and at the same time, it's actually quite difficult sustainedly to do. So what happens in the book is there's quite a lot of reading and research sort of below the surface, but I did try and keep it out of the book, because it's part of the problem is that you can't really explain in a novel. Explanation kills fiction. So there's lots of that kind of research that is sort of below the surface in the book.
So how can novels inform us about policy in a way that newspaper articles or books, magazine articles cannot?
Well, James Baldwin said this profoundly true thing, that the main way writers can change the world is by changing the way we see the world. In other words, Dickens didn't personally close any of the Victorian institutions that he wrote about, but he did change the way people thought about them and saw them and make them look morally untenable. And that was the thing that led to the change. And
just for our listeners, Dickens wrote extensively about asylums and prisons and other institutions in the mid-19th century in Victorian Britain.
And was an incredibly important figure in social reform, despite not directly being involved in social reform except through his fiction. And I think James Baldwin arguably changed the world too, not through his activism, but through the power of his imagination and through works like The Fire Next Time, which actually made people see the question of the racial division completely differently. And I think that's the impact you can have in a work of fiction. You can make people just see things slightly differently. And I think it links back to what I said earlier, but there's a particular problem with climate change in that it just is very difficult to face. It's very difficult to contemplate. It's very difficult to process this thing of catastrophic, global and permanent change. I mean, it's not the thing we can easily get our heads around, we can easily process. And I think one of the things that it's possible to do in fiction and in other artistic forms is to in a way slip past the radar, past people's defences, to make things thinkable in a way that it's actually quite difficult to look straight at them.
You express sympathy for people who deny the reality of climate change. And I think that's interesting, because many people who think that climate change is an urgent crisis are somewhat disdainful of people who do deny climate change.
Well, I think it's important to, you know, accept the realities of climate change and what it is, but why wouldn't we want to deny it? I mean, I do have deep empathy with the position of just wanting it not to be. I want it not to be true. You know, I would love to wake up tomorrow morning and I was going to say, look at the front page of the paper, but these days it's more likely to be, you know, look at the Twitter feed or something and see, you know, scientists decide climate change is a mistake after all. You know, that would be literally the best news any of us has had in our adult lifetimes. I couldn't empathize with it more profoundly. This, unfortunately, though, it's wrong, and it's a position we can't afford. We, you know, as a species, we just can't afford to do that.
But part of what makes it a hard conversation, it's not a binary question. It's often treated as a binary question. Do you believe in it or not? When in fact, a lot of the debate centers around questions of ranges. It's hard to believe all that carbon won't do something bad. But what I guess I found slightly reassuring is your scenario is kind of you've kind of gone to a worst case scenario, the 4-degree warming. And I think a lot of times people hear that and they don't really appreciate how much 4 degrees would be.
Well, that's 4 degrees Celsius.
Exactly.
Yeah, eight or nine degrees.
But, you know,
Fahrenheit.
8 or 9 degrees warmer doesn't sound that bad until you think about what it really means for, you know, wiping out the ability to farm in certain areas, you know, liberating lots of melting permafrost and pumping tons more carbon into the atmosphere just from naturally occurring sources and all these other kind of knock-on effects. So, but it's, I mean, I think it's part of the simplicity of the book that's good, is that it doesn't drag into any of that. It just says, okay, let's look at something that's close to a worst case and imagine what that would be. And, yeah, you know, and I think that's kind of clarifying.
In a way, with a novel, you have to pick a version of it. And as you're saying, it's a fan-like range of outcomes. And let's all devoutly hope that the lowest range of outcomes on that fan, that we end up more or less with the warming we've already had, which is a 1 degree centigrade, just over 2 Fahrenheit. It's a version of life we can live with, and we more or less already have. But with a novel, you need clarity. And the one I went with is, I thought of it in terms of, you know, the way that you get sort of economic graphs and things. There's a solid line leading up to the present moment, and then the dotted line stretching into the future. And I thought in terms of that solid line continuing basically in the direction that we've been on, and the International Panel on Climate Change, the UN body which sort of supervises this stuff, they have this worst case version, which is we don't change anything about anything and the climate warms in some of the gloomier versions, right, of it have it warming, and that is 4 or 5 degrees of warming basically by the end of the century. And that's the thing I imagined in the book. You know, and I wish it was the outlandishly worst case of all the scenarios, but unfortunately, it isn't.
No, it's within the range of plausible outcomes. And as an old boss of mine used to say, you just said, you know, we could hope that it's at the low end of this range of possibilities, but hope is not a plan.
Yes, and there's that Islamic proverb I've always liked, to trust in Allah, but tie your camel first.
That's great. Jim and I are old enough to have grown up during the Cold War, when the greatest worry was not climate change, but something much more immediate, nuclear annihilation. Is this age, this time we're living in, as frightening as it was then?
I think to young people it is. I mean, oddly enough, when you talk about intergenerational divides, which are a big thing, a thing I notice is that younger people sometimes forget. It wasn't masses of fun being, you know, 20 and 1970, 1980, 1985, double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment.
Actually, it was pretty fun, I have to say, despite the anxieties.
Yeah, well, we did have sex, drugs, and rock and roll that our parents didn't have.
We had sex until AIDS came along, you know, because there are micro-generational things about that too. The basic truths about, you know, we could afford houses, they can't, that's true, and the overall social contract having slightly shifted, that, you know, our parents were better off than their parents and they expected us to be better off than them. And that's gone away now. Our kids don't expect to be better off than us and we don't expect them to be better off than us. That's quite a profound shift. But there was stuff that was better. And people have forgotten the thing about the anxiety, I think, that, you know, nuclear war did actually haunt people's dreams. I used to regularly dream about the end of the world happening in the form of nuclear war. And this is an equivalent terror. I think one of the things that's different about it, though, is actually, oddly enough, it's a cause for optimism. I think it's that younger people process this very differently. They see it as a kind of, as an emergency, that this is a thing that takes collective action at mm-hmm. scale to solve it. And I think that's a cause for optimism. It's not one thing in one political system that you can go and march and change. It's a thing that we collectively can choose to act on.
And as a result, you say for the first time, age is actually a better predictor of a person's politics than income, which is true both in Britain and in the United States.
And that does feel like a shift to me, that traditional analysis of society, which is broadly speaking socioeconomic, and, you know, it's to do with affiliations of social background, economic background, what we think of as class, is just replaced by this thing of simply how old you are. And for things like the Brexit referendum, if you're allowed to ask one question, so the country was 52-48, I'm allowed to ask you one question to try and figure out how you voted. The most effective question is age. That tells me more than anything else. And this feels like there is a kind of change in the weather, change in the atmosphere in terms of just generations seeing the world differently.
It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And we're speaking with John Lanchester about some of the issues raised by his fascinating novel, The Wall.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
John, I'm interested in this intergenerational theme. How does it play out in the novel?
Well, in the novel, what's happened, my main character, Joseph Kavanagh, and I started to think about what would that be like if you had a world in which, in some of the more accelerated and grimmer versions of this climate change, you know, the change happens within a couple of generations or even in one generation. And Kavanagh in the book personalizes it. He blames his parents. He thinks they're the people who broke the world.
And Kavanagh's parents stumble around sort of feeling guilty.
I did think that, you know, this is like one of those things that you get in family arguments that happen when someone says something that's true, but it's not necessarily fair. So Kavanagh is completely telling the truth about how he feels, how he sees the world, his version of his parents. But at the same time, I did want the reader to think, well, you know, these poor middle-aged couple sitting there in the suburbs on their sofa watching TV, you know, is it really true that they broke the world?
Another part of the book I found really interesting is your depiction of what you call the others. What did you look at for inspiration for depicting these characters in the book?
Funny, it's one of those odd things I realized after I finished the book that was really powerfully present in it without my being aware of it. I grew up in Hong Kong, and a huge thing all through my childhood was the boat people crisis, which is now largely forgotten.
These are the boat people from Vietnam?
Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos, basically all Indochina,
who
fled in numbers at the end of the Vietnam War as you had various forms of social collapse. And they came in different waves. It lasted for 10 years, and there were tens and hundreds of thousands of people fleeing, and a lot of them came to Hong Kong. And my last summer there in 1979, I did some volunteer work in one of the camps where they were being held, from their point of view, indefinitely. And it was a shocking thing to see children effectively behind these, in what were more or less cages. And that was in my imagination, this image of starving, desperate people fleeing over water. I mean, Hong Kong, remember, is a society built by refugees anyway. So there's something doubly shocking about refugees being locked up by a country that's kind of created by refugees. But a thing that's largely forgotten, at the time people said, no, it's impossible. There are tens of thousands of them. There are hundreds of thousands of them. What are we supposed to do? Well, the answer is what the world did is we resettled them. 2.5 million boat people were successfully resettled all across the developed world. And, you know, you don't hear stories about, oh, you know, we took in some Vietnamese people and the society collapsed, or, you know, everything went to hell once the Cambodians and Laotians got here. That was an entirely successful thing that the world has forgotten it did.
Do you think that a sudden event, a terrible flood in a major city or an utterly disastrous hurricane, will be the thing that leads to a change in the way we look at global warming and climate change?
I mean, there's the scientist James Lovelock, who's a NASA scientist who's written very effectively, came up with that Gaia thesis, and he's written a lot about this. And he used to say that what the world needed was like the equivalent of a small benign heart attack, because sometimes people have a small heart attack and they completely change their life as a result of getting this scare. But you have to wonder, given some of the things we've seen, I mean, not very long before we're talking, had the hottest day in Australian history at the same time as we had minus 49 centigrade in Minnesota. To me, that looks a lot like that benign heart attack we're already talking about. You have these freakish records of temperature happening and these freak weather events happening already.
Because it isn't just global warming.
It isn't just global warming. And we have to wonder, I mean, it sounds like a terrible thing, but we may have had all the warnings we're going to get.
We are a solution show. So any thoughts around how we can look at this problem more effectively, or perhaps change the way we're thinking about the world?
I suppose my project in the book is to try and stop it from happening by imagining it. I think there are a number of things, collective action at scale, and I think that's the first thing. Individual acts of virtue are virtuous in and of themselves, but by being careful about our recycling, it's not going to save the planet. We are talking about collective action. I think the thing we'd probably start with, borrowing ideas from Charles Mann, who I think has written very well about it, think of CO2 emissions are a colossal thing, the single main thing we do to damage the climate. There are two main sources of it, transport and energy. Transport is tens of millions of people making individual decisions. The other half of those emissions are power, and that's coal. There are 3,000 coal power stations in the world. So if you think about it, tens of millions of cars versus 3,000 coal power stations. It's not too difficult to see which one we go after first. We have something the equivalent of a Marshall Plan to address carbon capture and storage from power creation. I think switching our diets would help a lot. I know, I'm not talking about, you know, the occasional hamburger now and then, but actually a fundamental shift in terms of how we address agriculture and the emissions generated by agriculture. And I think then there's all totally more technical things that have quite a big impact quite fast, like refrigeration, because the emissions from fridging and chilling equipment are very significant. So, you know, action at scale on the big things we can fix right now, and to not be shy about developing technology that we then transfer to developing and emerging countries and effectively give it away and act as if it's a world war, and the world war is already here and the enemy is climate change.
You mentioned some of the great works of literature that identified current problems and helped motivate people to address them, but also some of the most famous works of dystopian fiction identify future possible roads we could go down. You know, think of things like Brave New World or Orwell's 1984 that are warnings, and they're warnings of scenarios that so far we have largely avoided. I think, you know, the book like 1984 made such a vivid portrait of a surveillance state that it's always referenced as an argument against certain policies, and to date, reasonably effectively. Do you see your book playing a role like that?
I hope so. I mean, I think the odd thing about 1984 is that it's the time when it might have seemed truer. And if we were having this conversation behind the Iron Curtain in, say, 1975, we'd have been having it in private, in whispered voices, and, you know, making sure there were no...
I should say in the West.
Yes. You know? I mean, I think the most prophetic of those books is Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And he wrote in order to prevent the world from, he imagined, from happening. And actually, to a lot of his predictions have come true. He predicted a kind of systematic attack on privacy, that there would be Zuckerberg thing that privacy is an outdated norm, that mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg said. That could come straight out of Brave New World, where you know, you're deliberately supposed to share everything.
Also, the culture of people sort of entertaining themselves.
Exactly. The thing of entertainment as a form of collective anesthesia and a whole society numbing itself. That's in Huxley. Sex as entertainment, sex as a sort of morally contentless form of distraction, and again, almost anesthetic. So Huxley, he's right about most things. And I used to play this party trick one of saying, okay, there's someone who has meetings in a room which says on the outside, only good news. Now, is that the world controller from Brave New World, or is that Sheryl Sandberg? And the correct answer is Sheryl Sandberg. So, you know, Huxley's, you know, he's disconcertingly right. That in a sense, is his failure. The more right he is about the world we live in, the more failed his project was to prevent it from happening.
But it gives us a tool to push back.
That's right. And that's the thing you have to hope for in going the route of taking imaginative fiction, that you're giving away people to see things differently. It doesn't have to be like this. That's the moral of all utopian and dystopian fiction. It doesn't have to be like this.
John Lanchester, author of The Wall, thanks for joining us on How Do We Fix It.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jim, this was the first time we've spoken with a novelist about his nonfiction work. And it's also one of the first times we have very little to say.
I think we had a great conversation with John. And for once, Richard, I don't have that much to add.
Wow. Let's take it while we can. It's How Do We Fix It. I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm the unusually silent Jim Meggs.
Our producer is Miranda Schaefer. We're a production of Davies Content. If you're interested in making a podcast and the audience for podcasting is growing all the time, then reach out and contact us. We're at daviescontent.com. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.